The following episode of Annals on Call is brought to you by Annals of Internal Medicine. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and participants during this episode are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the American College of Physicians, the editors of Annals of Internal Medicine, or the institutions that the speakers are affiliated with unless so identified. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall.
Based on the aldosterone to renin ratio, these people look like they have PA. Yet, the confirmatory test says, no, they don't. We then subsequently went on to treat them.
Welcome to Annals on Call, a podcast based upon articles from the Annals of Internal Medicine in which we discuss the implications of the article for you, the listener. This is Dr. Bob Centaur. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and former Chair of the Board of Regents for the American College of Physicians.
This episode of Annals on Call features an article titled Confirmatory Testing for Primary Aldosteronism, a Study of Diagnostic Test Accuracy. Joining us on the podcast is Dr. Alexander Leung, who's a clinical endocrinologist and associate professor at the University of Calgary. I believe you'll have a much better understanding of the diagnosis of aldosteronism from listening to this podcast. Thank you for joining this podcast. As people who listen to this podcast regularly know, I'm pretty obsessed with the underdiagnosis of aldosteronism and why we don't do it often enough and what we're missing in terms of understanding management in our patients, and we have a lot of hypertension. So maybe we could start out by talking about why you thought about doing this study. And how does the impact of not having a significant percentage of aldosteronism diagnosed, how did that relate to you wanting to do the study?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I'm glad that you even framed it in such a way. I would say first that my research is informed by clinical care. So the vast majority of the research that I have, it's actually generated by seeing patients and seeing a clinical need. I think that's really the most meaningful way to do clinical research. And this is something that's not a mystery. I think that a lot of people have recognized and reported on this. There are simply very, very large diagnostic treatment gaps for patients who have PA. And it's very stunning. It's described by numerous groups around the world. And the reasons are probably quite complex. But I think that one of the reasons, and it's probably a large contributor, is simply how difficult it is to go through the traditional diagnostic care pathway for PA. It requires a lot of steps, and many of these steps are very technical. They require a lot of, expertise to do, and it's actually very daunting. It's simply intimidating for the average physician who wants to look after such patients to actually go through. And I've anecdotally spoken with many other people. Some of these are actually very experienced, very caring, and very well-skilled physicians who simply, they get intimidated when they even have the prospect of a patient with PA in front of them. They're like, oh, another patient that I have to do sequential drug washout on, or another person I have to put through multiple steps before I can even have a diagnosis, before I can even know should I be treating with some sort of targeted treatment. And one of the steps that actually causes difficulty is confirmatory testing. And I, by way of background, should say that I'm an endocrinologist, and diagnostic tests has actually been an interest of mine for quite a number of years. And for PA especially, but even for other conditions, many of the diagnostic tests that clinicians use, surprising to many who are frontline workers, actually have a very, very flimsy or difficult to justify foundations in terms of where they first came from, why they have continued to be used in practice, and exactly what the strength of evidence is for them. And one of these is the confirmatory test for PA. So it's something that has caused a potential hurdle for many physicians and patients alike to receive a diagnosis and therefore treatment. Yet the evidence base is actually not that solid, which we my team has looked at in the past with other I guess stringent systematic reviews and meta-analyses, and therefore that's actually what informed the current study. We really want to delve into how good does the confirmatory test actually perform when subjected to ideal design conditions?
So let's start from the very beginning. Patient comes in and has hypertension, and you say, "Well, I really need to work this patient up." What is the standard way, and how did you do the study to say that the standard way of getting to the second step was missing a lot? So the we're going to give the lead right away. The lead right away is, you probably don't have to do this confirmatory testing, but go through the process that got you there.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I would say it's a I have to be a little bit nuanced about this because the listeners to the podcast may identify that I might be making broad generalizations. But when I say standard way, what I'm referring to is the historical way of diagnosing PA, and that's well summarized by the Endocrine Society guidelines of 2016. But they do reflect actually several decades of practice even before then. Now, in the last 1 year or so, what's considered the standard way has changed with the release of the 2025 Endocrine Society guidelines roughly a year ago. And those guidelines are informed by the current study that we're discussing right now. So this study has already changed guidelines. So what is considered standard, a little bit more than a year ago is, I would arguably say, is no longer standard anymore. Whether or not that's actually penetrated into clinical practice, because guidelines do take time to change frontline thinking and work. But what I'll say is the historical way of doing it is the following. First, we see a patient. And as you recognize, this is a very, very common cause of hypertension, an under-recognized cause. And when we see a patient with hypertension, just based on probability alone, there's up to roughly one in three of these patients, if we just had to guess, would have PA, some form of aldosterone excess. And that's huge. It's one in three. Now, if the physician is keen and says, wait, I actually have a very high pretest probability here, and perhaps there's other factors that would even increase that probability further, such as hypokalemia, multi-drug hypertension, or person to have a known adrenal nodule, for example, they may then say, okay, I want to apply a screening test. And by far, the most common screening test for this condition is an aldosterone to renin ratio. There are some nuances in terms of how to have that measured, but supposing the aldosterone to renin ratio is measured in a credible way, and the physician says, yep, yeah, I believe it. And it comes back abnormal. So, in other words, elevated. Well, according to the traditional pathway, the next step is to perform a confirmatory test. And that's really the subject of the present study. The confirmatory test is some sort of dynamic maneuver. So, basically, in all endocrinology, if something's too high, you try to suppress it. If something's too low, you try to stimulate it. So, in this instance, something's too high. So, you try to somehow shut it down. And the presumption is, if it cannot be shut down, there is some underlying autonomy, meaning something is being released in a way that is no longer under physiologic regulation. And that's the basic idea behind the confirmatory test. We are going to try to shut down aldosterone. And in this case, we are going to saline load a person so that when we volume expand them, normally the presumption is a person should have a reduction in aldosterone. But in people with PA, it is traditionally felt that it will continue to have a high level of aldosterone despite volume expansion. Now, supposing that we trust the confirmatory test, and the confirmatory test comes back abnormal, meaning the aldosterone remains persistently elevated, then it's believed that we have secured the diagnosis and we can move on to the next step. And if the aldosterone is low, It is commonly believed that that will effectively exclude the diagnosis. The problem is that actually has not been objectively demonstrated in the past in a prospective blinded way with universal verification of all participants with a verifiable gold standard up until the present study. Well, let's suppose that the confirmatory test is reliable. Well, the next step would then be based on physician judgment, if it's something that would be clinically desirable, the patient would then go for what's considered to be a subtyping or localization study, meaning aldosterone really comes from the adrenal glands, and each person has two. And the fundamental question is it arising from one adrenal gland or both adrenal glands? And in those where only one adrenal gland is affected, the option of surgery is available to the patient. That means that if a surgery is offered to remove the affected adrenal gland, and there's a very high probability that the hypertension and hypokalemia will resolve afterwards, oftentimes resulting in a cure. And that's a very desirable and very favorable for many, many patients. On the other hand, if surgery is not in view, then targeted medical treatments, and many of these are very well established, and there's even many exciting new treatments along the way right now under study and one recently approved. But that's what we would offer to patients. Now, that being said, that would be the classical pathway.
Okay, so now we have the classical pathway. So what was your standard that of whether or not the classical pathway was giving you the right answer? How'd you decide that?
Very good question. So if you look at all the historical studies, and there's 55 of them that have looked at diagnostic test accuracy for PA, specific confirmatory testing, you'll see something very striking that's in common with all of those studies. And that's this. When we look at patients with confirmatory testing who are subjected to that particular test, we actually have to have a way of knowing whether or not the test result is true. So you have to have some sort of, so to speak, gold standard. And in the absence of a gold standard, you choose, I would say, a silver standard. But there has to be some sort of way of seeing what is true and what is false. Well, disappointingly, historical studies have chosen standards which are really not standards. Virtually all historical studies which have examined for the performance of confirmatory testing, they've actually used a reference standard that is itself a confirmatory test. That's two-thirds of study basically have confirmatory testing as the index test and confirmatory testing as the reference test. So it's a tautological bias. It's a tautological fallacy. We're using the test to prove itself, and it's a circular argument. And in cases where it's not a confirmatory test confirming itself, you'll see that there's actually a partial verification. So this is actually something that has tricked a lot of people for many decades in the past. So there's a very famous study decades ago, PowPET 2, that I'm sure all the listeners would be familiar with. But that's actually what they actually had a problem with. So for those who are listening, PowPET 2 was to look at VQ scanning to diagnose pulmonary embolism, and pulmonary angiography was considered to be the reference standard. But what happened was, if the VQ scan was abnormal, well, they believed it and they went on to verify it. But if the VQ scan was normal, meaning they thought there's a low probability of pulmonary embolism, they actually did not apply pulmonary angiography. So that's actually a problem, because if you do not verify negative cases, you're presuming all the negative cases are true. The false negative rate will never be known. Now, by corollary, the same thing actually has occurred in the field of PA for confirmatory testing. All positive cases would then subsequently go on for some sort of verification. But in negative cases, where the confirmatory test looks like PA has been effectively excluded, prior to our study, nobody else has actually gone on in a prospective way to verify whether or not the negative test is actually a true negative or a false negative. So we are really the only study up to this point that can objectively quantify what the false negative rate is. The reason for that is every single person in our study with confirmatory testing, regardless of the result, we didn't know the result. We were completely blinded to it. They went on to the next step, and that's adrenal vein sampling. And even at the point of adrenal vein sampling, we still did not know the result of confirmatory testing. If an adrenal vein sampling showed lateralization, meaning a patient would benefit from surgery, and that was true in approximately two-thirds of all our participants, we sent them to surgery. Even if the confirmatory test was negative, we did it. And we were the only study that had the, I guess, we were brave enough to do so, or some people may actually construe as being we're foolhardy enough to do so, but that's what we did. And conversely, if they show bilateral disease, then we just give them medical therapy. But this is the only way that we can universally verify whether a person had PA is with treatment response. If they have PA, you should respond to treatment. If you did not have PA, you cannot respond to treatment. And really, this is the only way that we could think of as a silver standard to verify everybody. We couldn't use pathology because ethically, you can't do bilateral adrenalectomies on everybody. It's the best that we could do.
Okay, so I come in, I have a positive screen, and then you do the venous sampling. What did you do when you could not lateralize?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And this is actually very crucial to our study, is this. Our particular center has a very high, very, I should say, well-established and skilled adrenal vein sampling program. So we actually have a very high success rate for adrenal vein sampling. So the listeners to the podcast may not realize that adrenal vein sampling is actually really, really tough to do. It's not easy at all. Depending on which part of the world reports on it, you can get success rates of 30 to 50%. And when I say success, to those who are listening, what I mean is to get into the adrenal veins, both sides, but especially the right side, is actually really, really tough. There's actually many other veins that can kind of look like adrenal veins. It can make it very hard to cannulate or successfully go into the adrenal vein. So when I say success, I mean we got into the vein that we wanted to get into on both sides simultaneously. And we're able to withdraw samples, and we're able to measure the hormones collected from the two sides. That's what I mean. Well, even in very experienced centers, 70% is a very good adrenal vein success rate. But in our center, and it's been published, it's been objectively verified with biochemical criteria, we've consistently now have had a success rate of 96% for over 2 decades. So that's actually crucial to our study, is it was very highly probable that people who underwent our study would actually have successful adrenal vein sampling. Now, that's the first step. Now, you actually asked about the second step, which is lateralization. Lateralization is simply looking for gross asymmetry between one side and the other. If one side is making a ton of hormone and the other side looks like it's making very little, and there's different thresholds, each center will use slightly different interpretation. But if there's large asymmetry, we typically believe that surgery would be a benefit. And that's oftentimes historically what we would call unilateral disease. Whereas if the difference between two sides is very small to indistinguishable, we'd say they have bilateral disease or non-lateralizing disease. And then in our particular center, for many years now, we simply have been able to select patients with a very high chance of lateralization. So in our study, roughly two-thirds of patients who went for this test actually had lateralizing disease. So two-thirds of our patients actually went on for surgery. That's a comparison to many other places in the world where only 20 to 30% actually are surgical candidates. We actually happen to have a large number of people who actually had surgery. So that's actually very, very important because there have been people who've read our study who've been a little bit critical, saying that the people exposed to the medical therapy arm, well, they say a lot of people re with resistant hypertension respond to medical therapy with spironolactone. So it's not surprising that your patients would too. But I would argue the reason that patients with resistant hypertension respond is because a lot of them have aldosterone excess, which we proved. But even if we were to exclude that, in our stratified analysis, those who exclusively went for surgery also had a similar result to the broader cohort in terms of how the confirmatory test performed.
Okay, so if you can do lateralization, most of them went to surgery, which was successful.
Yes.
If you did not have lateralization, you empirically put them on spironolactone, I assume.
That's right. The vast majority was spironolactone. There were some cases where the patient, based on preference, preferred another mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist, and that would be eplerenone at the time of the study. Finerenone was not yet released.
And in the people who had a positive aldosterone test, but a negative saline test, and you could not lateralize, did most of those patients respond to the mineralocorticoid antagonist.
Yes, so that's a very, very it's a very interesting question you just posed. So essentially, you're saying this: based on the aldosterone to renin ratio, these people look like they have PA. Yet the confirmatory test says no, they don't. We then subsequently went on to treat them. In this case, you're talking about non-lateralizing disease, and yes, the vast majority, over 90% of those people, responded. And also strikingly, of those who did lateralize with surgery also responded. So we actually cut the pie, so to speak, in many different ways. We sliced it in many different strata. No matter which subgroup we looked at, the response to treatment was very similar based on only the aldosterone to renin ratio test. The confirmatory test itself did not distinguish treatment response from non-treatment response.
Okay, I have two final questions. First is, if I recall, the 2025 guideline from the Endocrine Society says test everybody. Did
That's
everybody get
correct.
into your study, or did you just restrict it to people who had developed hypokalemia at some time in their course, had resistant hypertension, or you knew had an adenoma?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think we should walk back a little bit in that we're talking about two different steps. So the 2025 Endocrine Society guideline says we should screen everybody for PA with an aldosterone to renin ratio. When they say everybody, they mean everybody with hypertension. So in other words, depending on what our definition of hypertension is, maybe roughly 30% of the global population, they would recommend screening for PA. And I won't talk about the evidence base for that. I'll just say that was the recommendation. Whereas for us, what we did for the confirmatory test wasn't quite that, because we're one step down from the aldosterone to renin ratio test. The aldosterone to renin ratio test so happens in our clinic, the clinic where the study was performed, was actually applied universally to all comers who presented or re was referred with hypertension. So it just so happens that we, and you may argue we were a specialty clinic, so maybe our pretest probability of disease is different than other clinics. But yes, it's standard practice since the year 2005 until now, so the last 21 years, every single person that steps foot in our clinic gets an aldosterone to renin ratio test. And I should also say, since 2005 in our clinic, we have not used, apart from in a research capacity, we have not used confirmatory testing. Yet we have still been able to diagnose people with PA and meaningfully treat them and identify patients who have surgically curable disease.
And finally, if we're in a situation where we don't have the great ability to get adrenal vein sampling, and we have someone, now it's easy if you see a big adenoma, you might go down that road anyway. I guess we could send people up to Alberta, but that's going to be difficult. So if you were me and I see a patient, and we do the aldosterone, and it's significant, but I might not have as good access to surgery. Would you just start those people on an MRA and see what happens?
I love this question. This is actually the next big question. This is the logical follow-up to this paper. And I think it's really important for listeners to understand this. I'm going to say that in many, many, many places in the world, these tests that we talk about, that I brought up, adrenal vein sampling, is simply not available. I think we have to recognize the reality of this, and we have to be very practical. I don't want listeners to think that we're speaking from an ivory tower or we're detached from reality. For example, there's a journal, JCEM, Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Roughly a year or two ago, they actually published a very interesting paper, actually looking at Asia, and essentially reporting that in almost all of Asia, with very few exceptions, they simply have no access to such tests like adrenal vein sampling. So, in other words, an entire continent would be excluded from adrenal vein sampling, with, there's obviously some exceptions to that. There's
Sure.
some very large cities, but a very large segment of the world. And that's only one continent we're speaking of. We could probably say similar things about South America. In fact, somebody actually did recently publish that in South America, adrenal vein sampling is very, very scarcely available. So, in such settings, I think the best thing to do is simply to be realistic And we do the best that we have to treat the patient. And the best that we have is a mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist like spironolactone. That is the right answer for that particular setting. Because in the end, what we want to do is we want to provide the patient with something that is prognostically modifying for them, something that will help them down the road. And medical treatment is well proven to actually help alter the disease process. So this is something that I would recommend. Of course, there are some exceptions to the rule. It has been shown, and even our team has validated this too. There are very extreme examples where a very young patient with an adrenal nodule with extreme biochemical abnormalities, in such cases, can legitimately bypass adrenal vein sampling, simply go for surgery. But to actually look at only the extremes, I would say that's the tip of the iceberg. The frequency of that in the population of people who have PA is very small. So when we speak about these broad recommendations, I'm speaking of the 95%, those that we actually see on a day-to-day basis. If adrenal vein sampling is not available, I would not recommend that the physician, the family doctor, the internist, whoever's looking after the patient, simply say, "Uh-oh, no adrenal vein sampling, no point in screening then, because I can't take it further." No, that's the wrong answer. The right answer is screen, look at the screening test, and be a good physician. Being a good physician means take a history, take an exam. Does the clinical picture fit? If it looks like PA, treat the PA with whatever you have available.
Well, I cannot thank you enough for doing the study and explaining it all to us. I think this is a huge, huge addition to my obsession with Aldo, and I'm even more obsessed than I was before doing this podcast.
That makes me so happy. I'm spreading the love everywhere.
Now it's time for Bob's Pearls. This very interesting discussion left me with several thoughts. The first is the study suggests strongly that we might really not need to do further testing after we have an abnormal aldo-renin ratio. We can just empirically give a mineralocorticoid antagonist and see what happens to the patient. And this is because the confirmatory test was logical, but apparently it's not of high enough quality to exclude aldosteronism. This is the first study that's been done that looked at false negative results from the confirmatory test. They did not know, and they treated anyway, and the patients got better anyway. I hope that this discussion helps you think about looking for and diagnosing aldosteronism and helping your patients by getting much better blood pressure control. Thank you for listening to our podcast.
Information contained herein should never be used as a substitute for clinical judgment. For more episodes, links to CME and MOC, or to view disclosures, visit go.annals.org/oncall